Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Engineering Side of Data. Another special edition. We're going to be recapping the 2023 AWS reInvent conference that just took place last week. Alex DeBrie is here to help me do that. Alex, thank you for coming on. Please do a little introduction of yourself.
Yeah, Bob, great to be here. This is, I can't remember if this is the second or third year we've done this, but always good to be sort of recapping. Third year? Yeah, okay. So good to be recapping reInvent and hearing what happened. Yeah, I'm Alex DeBrie. I'm in Omaha here with Bob, and I do a lot of work with AWS, specifically like serverless, DynamoDB, and just kind of love the ecosystem and the community around it.
Excellent. Regular attendee to reInvent and a regular speaker as well.
Yeah. Yeah,
and you started a podcast within 2023, is that right?
I have. Yeah, so I started a podcast with co-host Sean Faulkner, which is it's called Software Huddle, so you want to check that out. I do a lot of focus on database stuff lately is what I've been trying to find people in that niche. Sean does a lot of people just from all over. He just spoke with Bob Moglia, who's like the former Snowflake CEO, had a really good interview with him. So yeah, he gets a lot of really cool guests. So yeah, it's been fun to do that. We release about once a week. So
Sure to catch that one. Bob's got his finger on the pulse of the industry.
Oh yeah, it was a great one. Just talking about like history of SQL, some of the Gen AI stuff, just like Snowflake and that growth and what enabled it with cloud and different things like that. And also just like growing a team and maintaining velocity. Yeah, just a lot of really interesting stuff there.
Oh, sounds fascinating. I'll be sure to include a link to the Software Huddle podcast on YouTube.
Thank you.
I'm sure you can get it in most any other place that you get your podcast.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, let's talk reInvent. Attendance seemed pretty good. First of all, full disclaimer, I was not there. I'm back on the every other year plan.
We missed
try
you.
Again
we
next you, year.
Bob. Yeah.
But from what I understand, there was a full house.
Yeah.
62,000, is that what you heard?
I hadn't heard any official numbers. I'd heard in the lead up they were aiming for, 60, 65, but I hadn't heard anything. So, it definitely seemed packed. It's, the worst part about it is just spreading it out over so many hotels where, especially the first day, there were some really good sessions of friends like at MGM and Mandalay, which are just so far south of like where Venetian are. And so you really have to like turn a full day into it almost if you want to go down there. So I was glad because like a few friends were speaking down there and it's like, okay, this is my day. I'm making the trek. I'm doing all these things. And then I can mostly hang out around the Venetian and Wynn and Caesars Forum the rest of the time. But it was a lot of fun. Got to see the Sphere and that was new to Vegas since last year, which was just wild. I didn't go in, but I could see it. And it's just fun to be there.
That thing looks amazing. I would love to go. I'd love to see a show in that.
Yeah. A few people went to like the Darren Aronofsky postcard from Earth thing, which is, kind of like a planet Earth type of situation, I think. Someone was going to U2 this weekend, I think. So just some really interesting stuff going on. I saw Fish is going to be there like in March or April, which I'm sure will be an experience for a lot of folks. So, yeah.
Yeah, that would be great to catch some event there. Even better if it was like a concert or whatever.
Yeah.
On to important topics. What about the hoodie? Rate the hoodie. What was it like this year?
I can't rate it. I almost never wear it. I think I got it home. Usually my wife takes it, if anything. I'm like pretty bad about the swag, actually. I bring like a fairly small suitcase and I almost always fill it up on the way there. So then it's like, okay, I can bring like three things home and that's it. So I didn't get a lot of stuff, but it was, I haven't even tried it on. I've barely looked at it. I think it was gray. I'm terrible with colors. Yeah. So like, I don't even notice things like that. So I'm going to have to abstain from the rating there.
We'll go 5 out of 10 just to keep it down the middle there until maybe we'll get an update on the review on that one. And you gave a talk again this year, like I mentioned. How'd that go?
It went well. Yeah. Spoke on advanced data modeling patterns with Dynamo. I think I started doing this in 19. So 19, 20, 21, 22, 23. This is my fifth year doing the talk, doing a Dynamo talk, which is tricky because I always want to include some new stuff because I don't want people to come and see the same old thing. But then it's hard to be like, I don't want to get increasingly wacky or something like that, or things that don't matter to most people. Yeah. So it's like, how can I emphasize something that's new, have a new example, but still be beneficial to a large group of people. So yeah. I hope that worked out. The one thing that I was happy about is just this was like a really good year for Dynamo talks. They had another data modeling talk, which was by a Dynamo senior principal engineer and a specialist SA on the Dynamo team. They also had like a Dynamo architecture talk from a senior principal engineer on the Dynamo team. And then like a bunch of really good like customer focused talks or different things like that. So I know like last year, 2 years ago, as a whole, there were only like two or three talks. And I just thought it was such a mistake because they're always really well attended and rated. And I think that's such a great service for AWS. So I'm glad this year they just had like a bunch of really good talks.
Yeah, great. Yeah. Overall, this seemed to be a very Gen AI heavy type of a theme.
Yeah.
Probably not too surprising to a lot of folks out there ourselves. A lot of talk about I'm sure that they did some pivoting this year, perhaps. Yep.
A lot it's of discussion kind of this about weird. Yeah, it's kind of this weird posture they have. They keep saying, oh, we've been doing AI for 10, 20, 15, whatever years. And it's like, just don't tell us. Like, release the, like, I don't, it's interesting what Amazon.com has done or even AWS on that stuff. But, like, what do we have to show for it? What can we use? And, and stop talking about how good you've been. I don't know. Just get the stuff out there. So, I think ChatGPT caught everyone off guard, including OpenAI, with just like its popularity. And now for every tech company, it's just been like, how can we get more and more of this out there? And that's, you know, doubly so for AWS, which is doing the, you know, shovels and pickaxes. So need to get some stuff out there for it.
They've been toiling away in the mines. They've been doing it, like you said, for a long, long time now.
That's what they say. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I know. Yeah. I heard that a couple times.
Yeah.
That's a nice, it's a good stance.
And had a little pot shot at OpenAI and, you know, their sort of interesting CEO board squabbles over the last couple of weeks. So, just kind of an interesting different vibe where usually it feels like AWS is like above the fray on some of that stuff and then had to get down in the weeds or down in the mud on it.
Yeah, they definitely take a, hey, we're the leader. Yeah. We're setting the tone. To hear that kind of sub-editorial type comments was very interesting, but they may feel compelled to acknowledge it to some degree.
I suppose. Yeah.
All right. On to more less drama type topics there. What was some of your impressions of pre-invent announcements? You mentioned you had a couple of things there.
Pre-invent, I think, was the most exciting part for me. Just in terms of like, you know, pre-invent being that lead up to re-invent where they drop a bunch of announcements. And usually they're like sort of little features, little different things like this, but that's mostly what I'm looking for a lot of these services nowadays. I feel like they're really maturing. A lot of the serverless services are maturing. There's not like, you know, whole services that I still need. Like EventBridge Scheduler last year, that was a big sort of new area, new focus that was huge. This year, just a bunch of nice features on other ones. I think Step Functions did a good job. That team is really shipping at a pretty good pace. Interesting one there is like being able to redrive failed executions. And the nice thing about that is like, you can redrive it directly and also it'll pick up from where it failed. So you don't have to like in each of your things sort of have a check of like, hey, did we already do this? If so, pass it on or something like that. You can just pick up right at that state where it failed and go. So if you had some sort of transient issue or different things like that, you can make that work now. So I think that was a really good one. Yeah, also absolutely. Just like they added a test state for step functions. So you can test an isolated individual state and assure what's going to come out of that. Really nice for that sort of thing. You know, third-party HTTP requests, that's a big one. I'm sort of surprised they didn't have it earlier, to be honest, but like it's great to have that out there. And so those are like, I think step functions probably the winner of pre-invent and around that sort of thing. Also some really nice limit increases. You know, these aren't like the sexiest things, but like SQS FIFO went from like 3,000 per second to like 70,000 per second or something like something crazy like that. And I think it was only 300 per second not that long ago. So like pretty amazing increases there. Also the Lambda burst scaling. So if you have a Lambda function that all of a sudden gets a lot of traffic, now they can add, I think it's like 1,000 new instances every 10 seconds, where usually it would take like a couple minutes to get out to be doing those sorts of increases. So some really nice stuff around that, you know, it's not going to be like, especially those limit increases one, that's not gonna be a thing for me and most of the people I work with, but like, it's really nice for a lot of big people and like just realizing, hey, you don't need to worry about this until much further than where you are probably, and just take that off your plate. So I like that sort of stuff.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Good crop of reInvent stuff. You mentioned the step functions teams really delivering. Yeah, I've definitely seen that, especially in a lot of the stuff that's come out this fall. And a little bit of a nod to the QuickSight team. They seem like they're really been delivering a lot of things. Every time I open up the big data blog or some other announcement sheet, they usually have a couple posts in there. They're doing good things though. They're really closing the gap to
Have you tried, do you work with that with QuickSight much?
I don't typically. Okay. Like I said, I've just been impressed at the rate of delivery and seemingly, you know, I do have some background in some extent about the data discovery tools like Tableau and you know, Power BI, and they seem to be putting in some key features to close those gaps.
Yeah, good. I remember like when it first came out, I was still at Huddle, and we looked at it quickly there, and it just like wasn't sort of close or competitive with other things that we were looking at and using. Yeah. But I do agree, like the pace has gotten pretty good. I'd be interested to sort of retry it if I had a good use case there.
Yeah.
So shout out to Amplify, AppSync, that whole sort of team. Like I think that's such a unique team within AWS, just in terms of like who their focus is, how they ship. And I think they had a really good pre-invent just in terms of AppSync had some new sources and different things like that. They had a good just 2023 overall with JavaScript resolvers, huge benefit for a lot of people. And then Amplify had basically a rewrite, a Gen 2, to make it, I think, address some of the issues with Gen 1. So I think they had a pretty good pre-invent as well.
Nice. Yeah. So much potential in that AppSync space, it would appear, you know?
I think if you have like one of those apps that's like, hey, it's very front end, you basically need a pretty generic backend for that sort of data storage type stuff, and a lot of your interaction is going to happen on the front end, man, AppSync is really, really pretty powerful for that stuff and just being managed for you and able to really ship quickly as like a, you know, front end full stack dev type of thing. It's really good.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, we talked about how the overall theme of the conference was Gen AI heavy. And a lot of it was perhaps outside of the world of maybe BI and data engineering that particularly discussed. But two things that are Gen AI related that kind of hit home for me are the kind of like that the Redshift querying interface that they released. That was interesting to see. I think SQL is a nice candidate for that type of a deal. I have not used it. I don't know. Maybe to see some promising results out of that. You know, they talk about how it'll take the intent, any querying patterns, any SQL things, of course, syntactically speaking. So, yeah, one to watch. Obviously, I think it's one of those things that's not the first tool to do that, but it is nice to see some movement in that area for Redshift.
Yeah.
The other thing that caught my attention from the Gen AI perspective, helping maybe data engineers be more productive, is the Glue integration. So the idea that you can say, hey, I have this source, I have this target. Oh, by the way, in between, drop all the nulls. And so they have some of that wizard-like job generation. Now, those kind of canned jobs have always existed, I think, since the inception of Glue.
Yeah.
But it's still nice to be able to maybe call upon those, and maybe as those patterns grow, and there's a lot of common things in terms of the world of ETL. So maybe they'll be able to capitalize on that and do more things from a natural language perspective when it comes to building Glue jobs. So pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah, that is great stuff. Yeah, I love that Redshift SQL stuff. You know, I think if you would ask me 18 months ago, like how far away are we from having something like that useful, I would have said like a long way away. Like that's just such a hard problem. Yeah. And then it's just one of those things that I think does fit pretty well in the ChatGPT, Gen AI type world and can really lower the bar for a lot of folks. You know, like there are a lot of straightforward engineering things you do. And the hard part, again, especially with data, is like, are you missing some of the nuance that is going to be tricky? Like I remember when, again, going back to Huddle, is like, we sort of made data accessible to everyone. They could all write queries. And sometimes people would write queries that were just subtly wrong, but close, you know? And then it's like, now you have like this bad data floating around. And that's going to be the Gen AI problem as well. But even then, just like, you know, helping some people out. I think like giving people the power, and sometimes they're going to make mistakes, I think is useful. Like, right. Even if you do have some mistakes that
come out. Absolutely. And I think by and large, folks tend to focus on that. Well, now we have these long running queries and we're spending more dollars here, but they never acknowledge the upside of all that in terms of getting more data in the hands of people who know what they're doing, right?
Yeah.
So I agree 100%. There is not without the landmines, but there's a lot of upside to automating that and allowing more folks to play in this space.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. And I think on that same note of these, like the CloudWatch logs had a similar type thing where you can be like, hey, I want to find this type of thing, right? And it's going to generate a query for you to like to run against CloudWatch Insights or whatever it is. So, because I mean, again, where you just have like those sort of opaque syntaxes, and it's like, oh, do I want to spend that much time looking through the docs or finding an example, tweaking it for what I have, whatever? Just having a thing that you can do some natural language against and get that back is really nice and powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Take a while to catch on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gotta train some of us folks who have been around for a long time to stop Googling and maybe take a different path.
Yeah. Yeah. I think with a lot of these things, I haven't tried it with these specifically, but even like with other ones, like right now I'm doing a project where I'm more full stack than I'm used to. I'm doing some React stuff, and I'll just be like, sometimes I'll just ask ChatGPT, how would I do this sort of thing? And it'll at least like point me down the right road. And now I know what to Google for or look for. Like I have the right language for it, right? I know what's possible or things like that. Even if I'm not going to just like copy paste that straight answer. It's like, now I know I'm not going to spend 30 minutes to an hour just like spinning my wheels being like, what is this pattern or thing called? Yeah. Which is nice. Yep.
Can be pretty powerful. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So over to you about some vector.
Yeah. Yeah, so sort of on the AI theme, but more of like on a operational OLTP like thing. You know, there were a bunch of databases that announced support for vector search. So vector search, basically what that is like, it's a tricky one, but a vector in this thing is like going to be like a large array of decimal points, right? So if you take some text or maybe an image or something like that, and you pass it through some model, what they're going to do is turn it into some, array of decimal points. And then those things, you can run sort of similarity search on those to find things that are closer. So if you think of like the very simplest vector would be like a latitude longitude, right? And you could imagine how if you had the latitude longitude for Omaha, you could figure out that, you know, Lincoln, Nebraska is pretty close to it as compared to, London, England or something like that. So using that, but now with a vector, now you're thinking of like, not just two dimensions, but like 1,000 dimensions or something like that. But what all these, databases, and we're thinking, what is it, DocumentDB, OpenSearch, we've Aurora Postgres, and Redis, I think, were the ones they announced at this, is basically they give you a vector search option where you can include a vector as, you know, a column or an attribute in your data store, and then you can run queries against those vectors to find similar type things.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one of those things, like, it's really powerful, especially with this new Gen AI stuff we're going on, where you can do, like, sort of similarity type search, which would just be, like, impossible with a traditional search engine type thing. I still think we're just super early days in understanding best practices around vectors, both within the database, but also, like, the patterns and data modeling you do with those. So I think a lot of people are going to be disappointed with performance if they put a ton of vectors in there and start doing queries against it. But I'm curious to see this space evolve a lot and figure out like, hey, what are the patterns we need? Because like, if you just think of how hard that search problem is, like, you know, even like a geospatial search is kind of like, databases are okay at that generally. But like now, if you think of not two dimensions, but 1,000 dimensions or 500 dimensions, like trying to find things that are close to that in vector space, like that's just a hard problem for a database. So there are a couple different strategies on how to do this, but like, what are the patterns if, you have a lot of data, but it's not changing. How can you index that well and sort of use that immutable index? Or as compared to if you have fewer items of data, but they're changing more frequently, so you need to be indexing sort of on the fly all the time. I think we're still seeing that shake out, but it's good to see these come out. People can play around with and start using.
Yeah, I can definitely see that being performance being an interesting thing to overcome, right? You know, querying by a primitive is much different than querying by some kind of a multi-dimensional array in the form, a vector, as it were.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But very, interesting stuff there.
Yep.
Some of the things that also came out, they kind of expanded on their zero ETL offerings, right? Mm-hmm. So last year, I believe, was at reInvent where they said, hey, for Aurora MySQL, we're offering this zero ETL piece. And then they came out with a few more integrations. A couple that caught my eye were, RDS Postgres, or I'm sorry, was it Aurora Postgres to Redshift, and then plain old MySQL RDS to Redshift. Pretty nice stuff there. Again, they call it zero ETL. It's more the E and the L and nothing of the T.
That's the T, yeah.
But that could serve a good ELT pattern pretty well, right?
Yeah.
It's spent a lot of time just building pipelines to take data from a source and publish it to a target. Mm-hmm. From what I understand, it's kind of all or nothing for a particular database, right? So you're not able to go through and say, hey, I want this table and not that table. You're going to get them all. So it'd be interesting to see how that evolves, how that changes. Again, typical service. Sounds great. Got some rough edges. It'll be refined the next few months and obviously years as well. Pricing looks good. There's no, hey, here's the pipeline price for any zero ETL integration that you have out there. Specifically for Redshift, of course, there's some, hey, don't forget if you're going across region, you're going to get hit with something. Don't forget when you add to your Redshift cluster, you're adding more data. That means more storage. That means more cost. So nothing specifically when it comes to the pipeline. Not a bad deal, right?
Yeah.
This combined, so this idea of zero ETL and then the Gen AI stuff with building out Glue jobs for more traditional ETL. Yeah, that seemingly some more automation tools will get better and better over time. And put me out of a job for sure.
You mentioned hey, it's good at the E and the T, not so much at the L, which is good. Like at Huddle, we did a lot of sort of ELT, right? Where we loaded it into Redshift and then would transform the stuff. Like a lot of stuff would work pretty well for that. Redshift is pretty powerful if you're doing just those bulk operations like that.
Absolutely.
Around. So that works pretty well, depending on the type of operation you're doing. Like we also had a lot of data in Mongo, which is these denormalized arrays and nested objects and things like that. And that was harder to sort of explode those out in different ways within Redshift. So we would do some stuff outside of Redshift, but a lot of transformations you could do in Redshift and work really well. So just
Absolutely.
Cutting down on some of that slog. I just remember maintaining those pipelines and babysitting them. And it's a pretty nice benefit for that.
With the addition of cloud warehouses and some scaling opportunities and tools like DBT, ELT pattern is definitely viable.
Yeah.
So this fits pretty well in there.
And on that same note, you mentioned the SQL ones, but DynamoDB had some pretty good zero ETL support as well. So you can do Dynamo into Redshift, which is a huge pattern, right? Dynamo is going to be really good at those OLTP things and really bad at OLAP, much worse at OLAP than even just relational Postgres or MySQL. It's going to be pretty bad at that. So the fact that you can get that into Redshift pretty easily, huge benefit there. I really like that. And then also on that zero ETL note, switching out of Redshift, Dynamo also has zero ETL into OpenSearch, so Elasticsearch, right? So if you want to, you can basically hook up your DynamoDB table to an OpenSearch cluster that you have, and it's just going to replicate all that for you. And it's nice because that's usually a two-step process. If you're doing this, what you need to do is assume you already have a table with a bunch of data in it. Now you need to export that table initially and get it into your OpenSearch cluster. And then you need to tail for changes, right? You need to listen to your DynamoDB stream and update and apply those changes. The new zero ETL integration does both of those for you, which is really nice. So less to worry about and manage and sort of all that stuff for it. The bummer on it is it does have a cost. There's a ingestion pipeline cost, so different than the Redshift integration, and it's fairly pricey. It's $180 at minimum for if you only have one OpenSearch compute unit or something like that. So that's a little bit of a bummer, but I think going to be huge for a lot of people. I see a lot of people that, have their data in Dynamo and then just want certain things that Dynamo doesn't give them, whether that's full text search or complex filtering or even just some aggregation capabilities, where they're replicating that data to OpenSearch, Elasticsearch anyway. So this helps them with this. I'm still like, I'm pretty partial to Rockset for this type of thing. I like them. I think they're a good team and basically handle this for you in a nicer operational way. But this is going to help a lot of people.
Absolutely. Yeah. Purpose-built DB to another purpose-built DB, whether it's Dynamo to OpenSearch or Dynamo to Redshift, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some big stuff there.
Yeah.
This obviously will be interesting to watch that space and see those that zero ETL stuff evolve.
Yep. And I saw they announced RDS now supports DB2, but they don't have a zero ETL from DB2 yet. So
completely missed the DB2.
Did you miss the DB2? I've never used DB2, but I've heard of DB2 and know of DB2. I thought it was interesting that they have support for it. But yeah, RDS now supports DB2.
Interesting. Yeah, from a data warehousing perspective, which I think is what most people use DB2. I don't think there's a lot of OLTP use on DB2. I could be wrong on that one. Yeah, but that's a good ad for them.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I imagine just like a lot of people like sort of like, hey, we're sick of maintaining our own DB2, but we don't want to do a migration to Postgres or MySQL or whatever it is. But like, can you get that off whatever our on-prem solution is onto the cloud? So it's at least like somewhat managed for us. I think that'll be beneficial for a lot of people. I imagine not a lot of people doing new projects with DB2, but yeah.
Amazon's done a good job of that over the last 3, 4, maybe even 5 years about saying, you know, things like, you know, oh, they could say, hey, come to AWS, you know, we'll help you migrate to DynamoDB and Kinesis and things like that. But now they say, hey, you know, we're going to have Sandra. We're going to have Kafka. Yeah. We're going to have his RDS options for SQL Server and DB2 and stuff like that. So they definitely said, okay, we're not going to make everybody come over to our product offerings. We're going to have these hosted solutions. And I think that's a good balance, too.
Yeah. Have a foot in both worlds, meet people where they are, and ease some of their pain, you know?
Absolutely. Okay, next up is the S3 Express One Zone stuff that was announced. Big announcement.
This is an interesting one. Yeah, this was interesting. I think there's sort of like what I initially thought it was, what a lot of people initially thought it was, and then what it actually is, but it's pretty interesting. So basically what S3 Express One Zone is, they're saying, hey, this is a lower latency S3, like much faster S3 read response times. And usually those response times can be unpredictable. We're talking hundreds of milliseconds. And they're saying, hey, no, it can be down into like single double digit, or like down to like double digit number of milliseconds for that. So people got excited about it. What it is basically you set up an S3 bucket that is in a specific availability zone within a region. So, you know, rather than being sort of across a couple of them, you'll say this, I want this in like US East 1A or B or C, whatever, you know, there'll be 4 or 5 availability zones in a region and it'll be in one of those specifically. And then ideally your compute is connecting to that directly. The more you sort of look at it and understand the capabilities and limitations, it looks like this is more for, hey, either like big data engineers that are sort of like, you know, writing some temporary files and need them quickly and maybe need a lot of clients to access them quickly, or it's infrastructure, especially like database infrastructure type people, I think are fairly excited about. If you're thinking like Snowflake or ClickHouse or any of the Kafka-y type things under the hood that might need to push it to object storage for like permanence and durability there. And different things like that. So that's sort of like the use case generally, rather than for like the average everyday Joe. Like especially like for me, if I'm working with a Lambda a lot, you probably don't want your S3 to be in a single zone. Like right, your Lambda, you're not even going to know which zone it's in most of the time within a region. So it's not for that. How it breaks down generally is it has more expensive storage than traditional S3, much more expensive storage, like 7 times more expensive storage there, but 50% cheaper on the operations, on the reads and writes that you do for it. So it's really meant for smaller files that are semi-temporary, not going to be hanging around for a long time, and that you need like more predictable response times for, which again goes like to those infrastructure-y type use cases. So interesting. I'm guessing like we'll get a lot of benefit from it, but more incidentally and through some of these infrastructure providers that we're using, Snowflake or ClickHouse or you know, some of the Kafka people, rather than use, like, I don't think I'll have a use case where I'll be using that directly in the near future.
Yeah. Everybody seemed to come out of that keynote dreaming of super fast Athena queries and EMR hits and stuff like that, only to discover that it is very specific use case. And if you're going to co-load your compute next to your storage and like you said, some more specific use cases. So exciting, but maybe not as impactful as you noted.
Yep. One thing that's kind of interesting about it is the way they're pitching it. They're saying like, hey, it has the same durability and availability as S3. And they say, provided a data center doesn't go down, which like data centers don't go down very often. So that's like true. But like, that's like sort of one of the things you're thinking about. Like, I guess most of the durability availability issues you're going to have are going to be, hey, an instance goes down and they know because you have it replicated, you know, 5 or 6 times different places, you're not going to lose that data. But it is weird to, I don't know, just the way they're pitching it that way. It's like, well, that's like a big provided, you know, like provided that data center doesn't go down and now I lose my data. But again, given like sort of the pricing model and especially with the storage being much more expensive, like I don't think these are going to be files that are hanging around for a long time. And now maybe that durability is sort of less of an issue for you. Given that, like maybe it's more temporary type data type stuff. So interesting. I'll be curious to hear, like just hear and read about people using it in interesting ways, but I don't think it's something that I'll be rushing to and using very quickly. Actually, now I think about it, one more interesting thing that they're doing about it is the auth model on it, which is basically rather than, you know, signing a request, an IAM request to S3, and they're going to check IAM at that place and send it back to you, what you're going to do is like create a session. There's like a create session endpoint. You get back a token that's good for 5 minutes to make these calls. And I'm guessing that token has sort of everything in it to validate their request and make sure it's okay, so they don't have to make an off-box call over to IAM and do that sort of thing. So kind of an interesting model. I'll be curious to see if we see that with more other services in the future to do some of that stuff. If you want like a higher performance auth method where you can say, like, hey, create this temporary session and use that for auth. I just thought that was pretty curious.
Yeah, that is a novel feature, that whole thing too, right?
Yeah.
Sense of building out the super fast storage if you're going to have to maybe have the same old auth method there. Definitely one to watch. On to some miscellaneous Redshift items. You know, we've touched on a couple Redshift related things with the Gen AI and the query editor enhancements there, the zero ETL stuff. That's obviously a piece that touches Redshift. Excluding those, not really a whole lot of bombshell announcements for the world of Redshift compared to the last few years. I mean, if you think about the last few years, they've really announced some groundbreaking things over at the Redshift world, you know, arguably trying to catch up. Things like the last year, I think they talked about the multi AZ deployment. That was huge. You know, Redshift serverless. Data sharing is another one of those items that have come out in recent years that have been massive. The obviously the very notable one, I think it was 2019, where they announced this, you know, you have compute and storage independent of one another. That was a big checkbox that they managed to tick off there. So this year, nothing. No biggies, but some, you know, some decent stuff. A couple that caught my attention were, you know, they officially, you know, they have the Iceberg support now. So you got Iceberg, and of course, I think it was in 2020 when they announced Hootie and Delta Lake. So they're kind of supporting the big three there in terms of open data formats. So interesting to see that. Certainly, it seems like Iceberg has definitely gained more attention and support from AWS. Interesting to see that the more and more Iceberg, that's just one example. The multi data warehouse writes through data sharing was also pretty interesting. Like I mentioned, data sharing before, you always do the read aspect of that, but now you can write to one Redshift database, and wherever it's shared, you'll see that reflected. So that's pretty interesting, and just kind of from a data sharing perspective, right? So once it's committed, everybody who has access to it will have access to it. They also mentioned, you know, hey, this could be nice for helping with workload management. So I guess the thought there is that If you do have multiple clusters and maybe some of them, or maybe one of them is underutilized, you could maybe write data there. And even though it's not, you know, as long as it has a share to it, you're good to go, right? So that'd be another way to kind of get creative with moving around and taking full advantage of your cluster and therefore your dollars. So yeah, that was a nice little add there.
Yeah, and then, that's interesting. Yeah, it's been good to see like Redshift, you know, really kick it in gear. I think they were ahead for a while. Snowflake sort of beat them out, as you were mentioning, and then NC and stuff. I think there was a pretty good talk this year about some Redshift under the hood stuff. I want to go back and watch. I heard some people recommend it. So, yeah, what else were you?
Excellent, yeah. There's another one that they have for Redshift serverless. They have some AI-driven scaling and optimization. So the idea that, hey, you could enable this preview feature. And then I think they even talked about having a slider that says, hey, I'm trying to be more on the performance versus cost. And you can kind of just with a slider bar kind of adjust to what's important to you. If you want to go down the middle, they'll try to aim for that too. So,
yeah.
Oh, that's yeah. Nice. That's a lot of little things that, that look pretty interesting. And yeah, they're still playing catch up, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Yep. They're still going after it.
Yep. Yeah. On that note of sort of like other big database news, they did have a few database, and like, I always think of Reema as like sort of like the big database announcements. It's gotten a little off that in recent years, but they did have a few this year. Aurora Limitless. I don't know if you saw that one. I think this was at the Monday night keynote with Peter DeSantis, but Aurora Limitless is, you know, it's a new version of their Amazon Aurora that's supposed to scale to like, limitless capacity. But I think they're moving from single rider to multi-rider on a single Amazon Aurora. So probably something more like a cockroach Citus type thing, you know, probably like Dynamo, but with a little additional features there as well. So interesting that I think that's still preview. So we'll see. It'll be interesting to hear more about the architecture and the limitations and what are those trade-offs for that. But I think some people were struggling with the single rider of Aurora, and getting this is pretty nice. And then on that same note, Elasticache serverless, right? A serverless version of the cache. It's when they announced it, I was like, hey, is this going to fall into like the true serverless stuff? Is it going to fall into DynamoDB, Lambda, S3, that type of thing, multi-tenant serverless? Or is it going to fall into the serverless versions of their databases like Neptune and OpenSearch and things like that? It seems to fall more in that latter camp, where you're paying for, you know, compute units or different things like that. It doesn't quite scale to zero. You're going to have like a sort of always on cost like that, which is kind of a bummer to me on, you know, for a caching, especially for a caching solution. We've seen Memento and Upstash, like this is a thing that you can do in a multi-tenant way, and provide like a pretty good serverless experience. It splits pretty well, so you can do shared type stuff. And it's just a bummer to me that it went down more like the OpenSearch serverless type route. So I'll be sticking with those other true serverless options for now. But at least they're like, you know, they're still trying to do some data stuff, and hopefully they keep picking it up.
Yeah, they haven't completely forgot about us, right?
Yeah, right.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, great. I tell you what, we've covered a lot of ground. Truly appreciate you coming on and sharing some of your insights from reInvent. And hopefully we'll be able to do it again next year. And folks for listening and viewing, thanks for all the support. Please rate, review, and subscribe. And we'll see you on the next episode.